introduce you to my mom or something.
I want to tell you about the Hadron Collider, and this is a picture of one of, there's two general purpose detectors at the Large Hadron Collider. This was one of them that I'm not going to talk much about, so I put the picture up, called CMS. And I also put this up because I was looking for a slide that said LHC, and I got this on the internet. But I was also looking for a place on the internet where someone makes a prediction that you could see an example of predictions that they make. And this slide was also that. This is where I got to say. I didn't do that. This is you want to check it out, it's there. And the word about there, of course, is this thing about black holes and produce the LHC and heat here. So that's how the talk is supposed to start. So the story will be, I want to talk about the LHC and why it's not going to kill you. The world may end, but it won't be the LHC that does it. And this is the way I like to organize it. So I want to tell you about, I understand we've got a lot of time, so I'm going to go on, and interrupt me if you have questions along the way, because often you should get them at the end. But so I want to talk about the machine, so the accelerator and the detectors, and the recent events, and that's, you know, they broke at some point, and what happened, and what they've done to fix it. And then I want to talk about what the goal is. So, and that kind of is about the present day picture in particle physics is there's a theory that works really well, except it has a couple flaws, and basically the thing is designed to see what happens to replace that theory. So I'll tell you what the theory is and kind of what the detail I'm looking for. And then I want to give you no one knows what it's going to see, and you hope that you're going to get surprised, but if you had to, people have been thinking about this for 20 years, and if you had to guess, there's probably three categories of things, one of which will be, whatever they find will be one of those categories. And that's basically motivated by the things that are wrong with the standard model, the theory that works really well now. So I want to tell you what those categories are. So what about the machine? So that's got two parts, the accelerator itself. You know, what it basically is, I'm sure you know, is it's a big 27-kilometer in circumference ring in which protons are accelerated in opposite directions, and then at specific spots they collide head on. And so if you looked at it from space, it would be big enough to see. So this is kind of where it would be. This is Geneva, and this is Lake Geneva, and you can see the opposite background. That's why people like to go there to work. Mm-hmm. And the lab itself is, I'm going to show you a better picture of it in a second, but it's you can't maybe see it very well. This is the airport, and the lab is somewhere along, right around where that circle is. So it's really big. In principle, it's big enough, except you couldn't see it from space because it's really underground. And so this is the same kind of thing. This is the previous picture was looking towards the mountains. Now we're looking along the valley. So again, there's Geneva. And it's all underground, you can see. And there's various detectors, four main ones, each one of which is connected to the surface by a tunnel. This one here, Atlas, I'm going to talk mostly about. That's the one that's actually underneath the lab. And these other ones are kind of around the countryside. And CMS is the one that the picture showed at the very beginning. These are kind of general purpose detectors. They're designed to see kind of whatever's there. And these other two are kind of aimed at very specific kinds of things. And so I won't say much about that unless you ask. So the idea is that you accelerate protons, and you stick them in this ring, and they go around the circle. And because if you want to get them to go in a circle, there have to be magnets, because the magnets are what bend the trajectories of the protons. And they're going at pretty much the speed of light, at the highest energies that have been reached yet. So here's a picture of the tube. So there's a tube. It's got magnets around it to make the protons move in a circle. And it's also evacuated, so you don't want the protons to be hitting air or anything, so it's a very high vacuum. And the magnets, in order to get them to go in the circle of that circumference, are very strong magnets, they're superconducting magnets. And that'll play a role when I tell you what the accident was. So in order to make the magnets that strong, you need superconducting currents, which don't have any resistance, and that involves cooling this whole thing down to something like 1.9 degrees Kelvin. So it's the whole 27 kilometers is a couple degrees above zero at liquid helium temperatures. And apparently, there's thousands of magnets there because it's such a big ring. One of the things that they tell you when you go on the tour is that one of the hazards they had when they were putting these magnets in, they all had to go down these tunnels where the detectors are, and then they go around the rings on these trolleys, these little trains. And the trains go at, 2 kilometers an hour or something like that. And one of the problems was that the guy driving the trains would fall asleep because, going around 27 kilometers, 8 kilometers an hour, so you could spend all day in case you're just driving this train around. So it's a very, very big, big project. So there's the lab. These buildings here are the ones that are above the Atlas detector. And Geneva's that way in this picture, so we're going to look in the other direction now. And the various facilities in the lab are there. Some of the older accelerators are there. The French-Swiss border kind of basically goes right along this fence and then right through the middle of it. So it's pretty on the edge. So did anyone see the movie Angels and Demons?
Mm-hmm. No.
Yeah. No?
I refuse.
The movie's in the book, I can give you that. I read the book, the Da Vinci Code. I thought this is interesting, but I don't really know anything about art or religion, and I have no idea what he's talking about, but he wrote a book on physics. I can see how well he does there. He doesn't do well. So it's... But he does, in the movie, it's a Ron Howard movie. This is Ron Howard, the director. He does pretty well for science movies. And I'm asking you about this because this takes place at CERN. If those of you who haven't seen it, it's the idea is that it starts off at CERN, and they're turning on the Large Hadron Collider. It's on already, and it's collecting antimatter. And the idea is that somebody steals the antimatter to make a bomb, and they go off and do something else. They get a lot. So the opening scenes are at CERN, and I want to show you kind of how well they do in that thing. Here they're in front of this big kind of spherical weird building, which you can also see here in this site. So they were actually there. The movie actually opens looking at that, and so they show you a picture like this, but I didn't actually get this. Is not from the movie. This is a photograph. But in the movie, if you go back to the movie, you'll see that there's mountains that are looming in the background in terms of the size of this thing. And the mountains are there, but they're, if you actually really see the mountains, they're in the distance, they're like down here somewhere. But they wanted to really emphasize to you in the movie that you're near Geneva. So the movie opens where you're going down this tube towards the, from the ground into the detector. And that's actually was shot right on site. This is the tube. This is the Atlas detector at the bottom of the tube. And then really, what you don't get in this picture is how deep that tube is. The detector is like a 4 or 5 story building high. It's really big, so it's like the east block of the Parliament Buildings or something. And then the tube is like the Peace Tower or more. It's really really deep, and everything had to be lowered down this thing. So they have these big magnets coming down, and they go down at an angle, and there's like a centimeter tall on each side. It's really big production building. So then they go and they show you at the bottom of this tube, there's a detector, and then over here is supposed to be the control room in the movie. And the detector is actually right. That's actually where it is and what it looks like. This is it again. These are the people that work on it, and it gives you an idea how big it is. This is the 5-story thing I was talking about. That blue thing is where the beam will go through. This picture was taken before it was finished. And this there's magnets inside this thing, but these big gold things are what they call muon detectors. Designed to look for specific kinds of particles. So that all was true. It's that big, and it's that size. The control room, though, is not next to it. So they switch the movie to the control room, where you're looking out now at the detector here. And there's a lot of things wrong with this, because no one's allowed down there when it's running, because there's radiation around it. So all the control stuff is on the ground floor. So the control room looks like this. First thing you see is no lab coats, right? No one wears a lab coat. Classic movie thing. And this is all done by computer control from the ground. Because no one's actually near the thing when it's running. So then they turn it on, and in the movie, they make all these particles and the antiparticles, and it's the next thing they get wrong, because when they turned on in real life, it didn't work. That's how I did. And then they make this antimatter, and they capture it in this magnetic bottle somewhere, and then that's the rest of the movie's about that. That part is actually not such a stretch, in the sense that antimatter, I don't know if you've grew up with antimatter, but antimatter, what we know now is that every kind of particle there is, for each kind of particle there is, there's another particle which has exactly the same mass and has exactly the opposite charge. And that's the antiparticle. And we know now that those things actually they could have been predicted to be there, and there's a sense in which they were, because they're required by the consistency of relativity and special relativity and quantum mechanics. If you didn't have any particles, there would be a fundamental problem reconciling quantum mechanics and relativity, and it's all to do with the fact that in relativity, simultaneity is relative. So that if we agree that these events are at the same time, there's somebody moving past us who thinks this one is first and this one is second, and vice versa. And then the lesson of relativity is that nobody's right. There's really no absolute sense in which you can order those events in time. And the paradox is that if you can't agree on how you're ordering things in time, then how do you really predict the future from the past, which is what science is all about? And Einstein gets away with it because the only things you can disagree with on the ordering of are those things where you have to go faster than light to get from one to the other to tell that you made a mistake. And so because you can never do that, you never run into this problem. But the problem with quantum mechanics is that in quantum mechanics, you're never really completely sure. If you know exactly where things are, you don't know how fast they're moving. So there's some chance it could be going faster than light, so the problem goes back. And it turns out it's an interesting story, but its resolution is that antiparticles had to exist, because if you were the person who had the, if you guys thought this one was first and an electron went from here to here and did something, but I think this is first, I have to have a story I can tell myself too. And my story involves the antiparticle going in the other direction. And so but for it to work, it has to carry exactly the opposite charge, it has exactly the same energy, and all those other things. So it's a huge triumph of relativity and quantum mechanics that you find these antiparticles. And they were found in the 30s, and now it's old hat. That whole miracle story is not really taught in textbooks even anymore. It's kind of taught mundanely that antiparticles exist, but it really was a fantastic thing that happened. So then the right, these things exist, and because they have the opposite charges of particles, when they meet, they completely annihilate into things like radiation. And so an electron meeting an anti-electron or a positron would completely vanish into photons. And that's a reaction that's very common. And vice versa, when you collide protons with each other in the LHC, you typically produce particles and their antiparticles all over the place. So the rule of thumb is kind of half the things you're producing are antiparticles. And so that part of it was right, that they, not just the LHC, but all the accelerators that have ever been built pretty much have produced as much antimatter as matter. So that's that wasn't a place where they were getting things wrong with the movie. It's also true that the idea was this is a much more powerful weapon if you could have it. And that actually is also true, because if you think about it, you know, chemical weapons are extracting the energy to do with the how the electrons are bound to the atom, and that's something like you know, a part in a million or a part or less of the total. If you take the total mass of the atom, and you take the binding energy electron, it's about a part per million of the total mass. So you're liberating that much energy when you do a chemical reaction. Nuclear reactions are doing the same thing for the binding of the nucleus, and then it's about a percent. The energy changes in rearranging the nucleus are about a percent of the energy that you would get if you took the whole mass of the nucleus and made it into the energy. But in antimatter, if you think about it, you take a proton and an antiproton, or a nucleus and an antinucleus, and they meet each other, you get everything, because all the energy comes out as radiation. So it's about 100 times as powerful, pound for pound, as you would have had in a nuclear bomb. So the idea that antimatter would be a big weapon would be that's also not wrong. It's also hard to track, because if you make it put in a box, it finds the edge of the box and annihilates, and so you would have to do something like magnetically trap it, but that's also true, people can do that. They've actually trapped antihydrogen in CERN, and they study its properties, and it's not easy to keep, they get rid of. The reason they don't still have the antihydrogen is that they all had to go. At Christmas, they went home for vacation, and they didn't want to pay somebody to stay there and keep the machine going. So they turned it off, and of course it went poof, and then they would have to make more.
Did you destroy the Vatican?
Didn't destroy the Vatican. If you've seen the movie, the thing ends in the Vatican, you know, and the bomb goes off. If you've got a bomb, it's like a gun in a murder mystery, right? There's a bomb in the movie, it's got to go off. But the way they get away with it is the guy flies off with it in a helicopter. And you might ask, if you had a bomb in a helicopter, where would you go if it's going to go off soon? He does the stupidest thing possible, he goes straight up. So there's a lot of things wrong with that, right? One is that you could then go straight down. The other thing is that in a helicopter, you can't go very far up. You know, you can go the ceiling of a helicopter is 15,000 feet or something. What's that? A couple miles. So you essentially fly a couple miles away, and then you set the bomb off. And a nuclear weapon a couple miles away, they often detonate nuclear weapons above cities because they do more damage that way. So if you're ever in that situation, you know, The weird thing was that the book is hard to. One of the things that's hardest as well in the book is that the guy goes up in the helicopter and he jumps up without a parachute and he makes it. Right? So,
yes.
And he's on a schedule that night, right? So he gets down and he finishes his schedule. That's the part that kind of hurts as well. But what we're getting on here is the total number of antiparticles produced. If you run the LHC for its entire lifetime, for 20 years, you get something like 10 to the 15 antimatter particles, and 10 to the 15 particles. And you think about 10 to 15, that's, you know, Avogadro's number is 10 to the 23. That's not a lot of antiparticles. And so it's not a very efficient way to get antimatter. And so getting a significant amount of this stuff is the thing that's not happening. So that's why people don't really, they do have security there, but they're not, it's not a pressing worry that people are going to get antiparticles from the LHC. So the other recent events were the turning on of the LHC. This is a picture of when they first turned it on. It's a cross-section of the beam. This is one of the beams. The protons have been one way. This is the protons going the other way. It was all working like a charm. You can't read this, but it's this is in centimeters or something like that. It's some, or millimeters. It's some very accurate little beam. And then immediately, it blew up. And so, so what happened? This is a picture of those magnets. And you've got to see these magnets. You know, I showed you a picture of the magnets in the tunnel. Those are, you know, screwed into concrete with bolts like this. It's like a battleship. And this thing went in, they had the accident, kind of picked it up and put it down again. And so it did a lot of damage. And the whole, of course, once you pick up one end of the magnet, the other end was off, and it knocks the next one off. And so a whole bunch of them went at once. So it was a big deal, and they had to fix this. This picture is actually fairly cosmetic compared to some of the things that they saw. And all the liquid helium boiled. You have visions of people coming out. No one was there, actually, but if people coming out from all the helium going, so in that frame, yeah, there's me over there again. The lab's over there. The accident was over here, near the mountains. And they went through and they fixed let me first describe what the problem was. So these are all the magnets. They got, you know, thousands of these magnets they put in there. And each one had to be welded to the next one. So here's a picture of one of the welds. You can see a lot of connectors there. And the basic idea is, the important thing is this copper bar. And remember, I told you that this these are superconducting magnets. And so there's a wire that goes around 27 kilometers, which is superconducting. It's at 2 degrees Kelvin, basically. And the insulator for that wire is copper. So you're normally thinking of copper as being what you make wires out of. For a superconductor, that's an insulator, because that resists a little bit. And so they wrap this copper, this superconducting wire, with copper. And the reason they wrap it with that rather than the insulator is that if you ever should happen to lose your superconductivity, so if your helium boils or you go above 2 degrees Kelvin, then your superconducting wire will no longer superconduct, and that current's going to go somewhere. And so you want it to go somewhere that's not destructive, and so they have this bar, which is where it'll all go. And what you're seeing, so they had to be all welded together here, and then these are the flaws that were in these welds that they later on went back and found. And that was the cause of the problem, because when things are normally working, if this is the superconducting current, and this is the copper bar that's next to it, and as long as it's superconducting, you don't care how good the welds are in the copper bar. But if you, what's supposed to happen is that if you no longer superconduct, the current moves to the copper bar. But if you've got bad welds at these connections here, you won't have a problem as long as it's superconducting. But as soon as something goes wrong, and it tries to go to the copper bar, then it can't go any farther than the first magnet, and then the energy has to go somewhere. And there's a lot of energy, even though there's not many particles, there's a lot of energy in those beams, and so that's kind of where the damage comes from. But there's thousands, and so not only is there physical damage, there's a whole bunch of crap goes down this vacuum pipe, which has got to be very clean. So these things normally, this is a picture down the pipe, it's supposed to look pink when you just look at the normal copper in the beam. In the pipe, but all this gray stuff is the soot and stuff that went down the pipe.
Cliff, was the superconducting material, is it still niobium, or have they gone on to better material?
I think it is, but I'm not completely sure, actually. They're not using any of these IBC things. It's because those are ceramics, so they're actually hard to work with. So it's old-fashioned superconducting. So they replaced a lot of these magnets. So they replaced 14 particles, 29 dipoles. So not all of them, but 1,000 of the magnets, and they replaced the ones that were in the bad area. And so given that they've realized there was a problem, you might say, well, why didn't they check all the other magnets that didn't break? And so they got a problem there because they in order to fix the wells, we have to take this thing and warm it to room temperature, and then fix the wells, and then cool it again. And that warming and cooling thing takes about a couple months. And that ring is divided into octants, so you have to warm in whole octants at a time. And an additional problem is that when you warm the helium and it boils, there's not enough storage space for all the helium. So if they actually wanted to warm the whole thing up, they have to would truck away the helium as they made it into a gas, and then they have to truck it back when it was when they wanted to put it back in. And and they don't want to get rid of the helium because there's a whole other story about helium becoming expensive. It wasn't expensive when they bought it, but because of the American government making some funny choices, it's going to become expensive very soon, and they can't afford to let the helium go. So what happened was in these octants, these are the octants schematically. The blue ones are ones that are, once they had the problem, they didn't warm everything up to room temperature, they warmed it to liquid nitrogen temperature, which is 80 Kelvin. And so these blue things are things, octants that were left at 80 Kelvin. The red ones were the ones that were warmed up to room temperature, 300 Kelvin. And so the ones that had to be fixed were fixed. These ones here had to be warmed up to be fixed. There's one octant which was warmed up even though it didn't need to be fixed. And what they've done is once they realized what the problem was, they could measure the resistance between these magnets, and they could tell if there's a bad weld in there just by measuring the resistance. So they immediately went through and they measured all the resistance in these magnets. And then the ones that were warmed up, they could do a pretty good job of seeing which ones have problems in them. But in the ones that aren't warmed up, the resistance is much less, and it's harder to tell if the problem's there. So in this one that was warmed up, they did it both ways so they could calibrate how big a resistance they would have if they had a problem. And they used that to infer how many things that they figured would be in trouble in these other areas that they never warmed up. And because of that, they think that they know where the problems are and how bad they are, but they don't want to run the machine at full energy because until they've actually fixed all these magnets. So the plan is that they're running now, and they have been running since February, at 7 TeV, which is half their design energy. And they're doing that because that's what they think is safe, given that they haven't fixed all these magnets. And they're going to do that for a year, till the end of December next year. And that's more or less chosen to allow them to get enough data, as Fermilab in Chicago has already accumulated at lower energies. And then they have to, I think very soon actually, later this fall, they switch over and they stop sending protons around, they start sending heavy ions around as like gold nuclei or something. And they do that because in the old days, in order to fund this whole thing, they had to get money from the heavy ion community, so they had to agree to run it in this heavy ion mode. And so they're going to do that for a little bit, and then they're going to shut down and then fix all the rest of the magnets and then run it at the full energy, and that'll probably now be a year and a half from now. So that's kind of that's why there's a delay, and that's what the plan is. So it started again last September, and things worked really well again. People had their fingers crossed. This is when they set a new record, and it wasn't the number of people in the control room. It passed the energy that was available, the highest energies that had been reached elsewhere. And that's where we are, basically. So that's the accelerator. Now, the detectors are just as important as the accelerator because once you make these collisions, you have to figure out what happened. And so there's two main detectors. And I'm going to talk mostly about the Atlas detector because that's the website I went to. Also, that's where all the Canadians work. There was a conscious decision in Canada to have all the experimentalists in the same experiment so you don't spread your money around too much. There's 3,000 PhDs on each experiment, so we're still a small piece of that, but we punch above our weight, I think, it's very the same. And this is also the one that's underneath CERN itself. So the idea is that these protons collide with each other inside this detector, and then what I want you to get across in this part of the talk is why are these detectors built to be so big, and then the way they are, how do they achieve the end of seeing what went on in these collisions. So they're basically big cylinders. The big gold things that you're looking at in the first few slides are these things on the end here. And this is where the beam goes through. And it's a bunch of concentric things that are designed to detect different kinds of particles. And I'm going to show you a movie which kind of takes you through what these various things are in a way which is better than just looking at that picture. These are the magnets. These are the big magnets. These are not the magnets that are keeping the things in the beam going around in the circle of the beam. These are additional magnets that make particles move in curved tracks in the detector, so they can tell which kind of particles are which because how strong or curved the track is depends on the mass, and then that gives you an idea of what the mass of the particle is. And so the main thing you need to know, though, for this description is what you're hoping to happen is that the protons collide. And protons are messy things. They're built out of other things, like quarks and gluons. So it's like colliding two things, two garbage cans or something together. There's a spray of things that come out, and you want to, and you're hoping that, that you produce particles and antiparticles of the things that you know, but also particles we haven't been able to produce before because we didn't have enough energy. But if you produce a new particle, almost always what happens is that particle decays very quickly. And the typical lifetime for the particles we already know about that are, have these kind of masses is something like 10 to the minus 23 seconds. So even moving at the speed of light, those things are traveling at 10 to the minus, they may traverse a nucleus before they decay. So you're not seeing the new particles themselves when they get produced. You're seeing what they decay into, which is ordinary particles that we already know about. So these things are designed to detect particles we already know about, but to infer things like their momentum and their energy so you can reconstruct where they came from in the collision. And so that's where the movie comes in. So unfortunately, I've got kind of a kludgy little machine here that doesn't, not very, oh shoot, I went to the wrong thing. Time and this won't run. Wait a second. There's kind of there's sound here more for what they're going to say rather than there's music also. It looks like they have some hokey music to play these things.
The detector consists of many components. These are needed to measure the different types of particles produced in the collision, which then pass through ATLAS.
Collisions are down here.
The intersections measure the tracks of charged particles, which are bent by the magnetic field of a thin superconducting solenoidal magnet. Outside of all of these are two calorimeter devices measuring the energies of particles.
You'll see that, but you see their energy.
Finally, the muon spectrometer measures the tracks of muons, which are bent in the field of the superconducting toroidal magnets.
Those are the ones you saw.
Here is how ATLAS detects different types of particles. An electron will plow through the inner detector, leaving a track behind before finally stopping in the electromagnetic calorimeter. A photon behaves in a similar way, but leaves no track. A proton leaves a track and interacts primarily in the hadronic calorimeter. A neutron behaves in a similar way, but leaves no track. A muon passes all the way through ATLAS, leaving tracks behind.
Charged, massive, but doesn't strongly interact with nuclear.
Finally, a neutrino passes through ATLAS without being detected at all.
That sucks. Neutrinos, there's 10 billion neutrinos within every square centimeter per second at the surface of the Earth coming from the sun. The fact that you don't know that is because they don't interact much. Know that in the sense that you don't see them. It's not that they're not hitting. They're hitting you all the time, but they're not doing anything. They go through the Earth for the most part, and they don't do anything. They miss. So you have to go through light years of lead to have them hit. If you have a beam of neutrinos, you have to go through light years of lead to have it actually stop because it interacts with things. So it's very hard to see neutrinos. But not impossible, but it's very hard to see. So the main thing there was you're distinguishing the kinds of particles based on their having different charges, having different masses, and having different interactions. The protons and neutrons interact through the strong and the electromagnetic interactions, whereas electrons only interact through the electromagnetic interactions. Neutrinos don't interact with either, and that's kind of why they get through the whole thing. But by designing the detector carefully, the idea is you catch everything coming out, and you can reconstruct the energy that the particle had and where it came from, and so you can figure out that these particles all came from this particular spot. And they add up to the mass of the particle that could have been produced. And so you kind of figure out what produced all these things. That's the plan. And they worked. I mean, they before they had the detector running, these things were sitting on, they're being bombarded by cosmic rays all the time. And so they knew that the detector was working because they could see these particles. They don't normally worry about those because those particles don't come from the middle of the detector, and they have a computer system that, that doesn't allow them to, it doesn't record an event that's coming from the space. So it's been running, and it's been running since, the, this is actually a collision that took place when the machine was running, so these things were all coming from the middle, so this is kind of a, the way that they represent what they see. It's just a bunch of energy coming out, and it shows you where the tracks are, radiating from that point where the collision took place. And they've written papers on it, and they're not very interesting papers yet, but they will be more interesting as they find more things. So that's where they are. They're kind of, they're kind of, right now, they're really understanding the detector better and better. They want to really, you know, the name of the game will be to know that they haven't missed anything. And the way they're looking for things that don't look like what you would have expected from the standard theory, which I'm going to talk about now. And the way you make sure that's true is you really look for the things that the standard theory does predict, and then you make sure you're understanding them very well. And that's where they are right now. They're understanding the standard model pretty well. They're rediscovering all the things at the top fork that have been found elsewhere. They're seeing how it works. So what's the standard model, and what's the goal? The goal is it kind of falls into this grand historical picture where the understanding of bigger things is coming from smaller things. And so if you kind of work your way down, you know, we're made of cells, cells are made of molecules, molecules are made of atoms, atoms are made of nuclei, they are made of quarks and gluons, and so on. And then this is the idea is that the energies involved here are small enough that you can look inside what we, for all present purposes, electrons and quarks are point particles. And this is meant to look, higher energies mean that you get to look at smaller distances, and this is meant to look at those smaller distances that have never been looked at before. And so the goal is, you know, this is often, this kind of reductionist picture is often unfashionable now because there's a cartoon reductionist picture, which is not what this is, which is easy to criticize, and that is that, you know, this is a special case of nature has comes to you with a variety of scales, and it's, well, you know, we know that we can understand them one at a time. You didn't need to understand nuclear physics to understand atoms, and that's science progresses because you can do that. And it's not just particle physics, you know, it's, you have a room full of students. You know, a lot of the reason why they behave the way they do is because of the hormones in the student, but it doesn't mean that a good way to predict what students are going to do is by looking only at the hormones. You know, so a cartoon of criticism of this would be that, well, you know, you're never going to understand complicated things in terms of the atoms or the particles that are in them, and that's true. You're not trying to understand complicated things in terms of the atoms. But when you do understand complicated things like materials or superconductors, you do that in terms of given things, like the mass of the electron, or if it's students, it's, you know, or the hormones that they have in them, and other things. And the things that you're explaining things in terms of, you ask, kind of, why is a nucleus small compared to an atom? It's because an electron is light compared to a proton, say. And it's because electromagnetic forces are weak compared to strong forces. But if you then want to ask why are those things true, you have to go a level deeper. You have to say, well, the electron's light because of this. We don't know why it's light because we don't know what that level deeper level is. But there's a part of the story is what's going on at smaller distances, and that's what we're aiming at. So I want to tell you about what the standard model is, why we believe it's true, and then why we believe it's not exactly true. So it was invented by these three people. This is Sheldon Glashow, Abdusalam, and Stephen Langer. And it involves these particles. It says that everything, not including gravity, that has been seen is described as the interaction of these particles in this list. And there's quarks and there's leptons. The quarks are the ones that take part in the strong interactions, and there's actually three colors of each of those. And then there's the things that mediate forces that they feel. And in the standard model, there's three of those forces. There's the electromagnetic force. There's the mediated by the photon. There's the strong force, which is mediated by the gluon. And then there's the electro weak forces, which are mediated by the W and the Z bar particles. And those are massive particles, so those are very short-range forces. And they're kind of responsible for things like radioactive decays. The strong forces that hold the nucleus together. And almost everything that you see in everyday life is in this column. It's made of electrons. Here's the neutrinos that you may not have seen them, but they're around. And up and down quarks are what make protons and neutrons up. And so all of ordinary matter, more or less, is in that first column. But it happens that there's a copy of all those things which just differ, have the same properties, but just differ in the mass. So that the muon, that was the thing that they were looking for in these detectors that go right through, is just like an electron, but heavier. And no one knows why there's three copies of everything. That's one of the mysteries of nature, and it's just the standard model just takes it as given that those particles are there because we've seen them. But the standard model actually has one more particle in it, which is the Higgs particle, which has not been seen. And so one of the tests is that this is to look for this Higgs particle. It's got very specific properties. And so the first part I want to tell you about is why you think that the Higgs particle is there and what it is. So the Higgs particle is believed to be there because it's associated with what's called the Higgs mechanism. That's Peter Higgs here. And the Higgs mechanism is an idea that was invented by Rauch, Nagler, and Anderson. That's why it's called the Higgs mechanism. What happened was Higgs actually says this himself, that these guys kind of showed that this mechanism was there very generally. But what Higgs had was a really simple model that everybody thought. And so when Higgs went around and gave his talks, everybody said, oh yeah, that makes sense. And they didn't really understand what the earlier papers were about. And so when they talked about it, the influential people said, oh, you know, it's that Higgs thing that Higgs said in his talk. And so they got the name Higgs magnitude from that. So it's going to be an interesting call when they have to assign a Nobel Prize for that one, because only three people can get the Nobel Prize. And I've always wanted to write there's lots of examples of this, four people who could get the prize. And they very often have strong personalities, and it's a mystery novel that needs to be written, is where one of them dies under mysterious circumstances.
Just before the award.
Yes, exactly, right. If you write that, I want a piece of that. Anyway, so the Higgs mechanism, what is the Higgs mechanism? The Higgs mechanism is it's the reason why particles get mass. It turns out that there's a symmetry in the standard model, which, and the reason it took the standard model so long to figure out was, if you take the theory that describes this, the force mediating particles at the photon, there's a symmetry which says that they should always have no mass at all. So they should have no rest mass. They should always move at the speed of light. Not only that, all the particles that they talk to, like the electrons, should also have the same property. They should always move at the speed of light. They should not have any mass. And that's obviously wrong, because we know the electron has a mass. The W and the Z boson have masses. The photon doesn't have a mass. That's kind of why people kind of were able to figure that theory out to start with. But it was a long-standing problem as to why, how you get around this problem, that the theory really wants you to have no mass. And the resolution, so of those three people, Glashow was the guy who kind of figured out what the symmetries were. It was Salam and Weinberg who figured out this mass issue, and they're the ones that were able to make it into a real theory that didn't have this problem about masses. And so what they realized was that you have to separate in your mind two separate issues. One of them is symmetries. I say this is a symmetry. It's like a symmetry in the same sense that the laws of nature are invariant under rotations in space. That doesn't make a difference. There's no absolute preferred direction in space. And so that's why Newton's laws is expressed in terms of vectors. Those are things for which a vector being equal to a vector, everybody agrees that's true, regardless of what particular reference frame you choose to describe it in terms of. So that kind of a symmetry is what I'm talking about. But you need to distinguish between symmetries of the equations of motion, like Newton's law, F equals ma, distinguish that from symmetries of the solutions to the equations of motion. So even though F equals ma is a law that everybody agrees on no matter how you rotate it, it can happen that a trajectory of a particle goes in that direction. And so that the specific solutions to the equations of motion can choose a direction, even though the equation would have allowed all directions. And it's initial conditions in that case that are telling you what the special direction is. And so the observation is that the way you make that work for masses is to think not so much about Newton's laws, but think about something like a ferromagnet or something. Some condensed matter system. If you're living in water or you're living in an environment, say, then that's another example. Ferromagnets, things that have spin, things that carry magnetic fields, are another example like what I was talking about for Newton's laws. The laws that describe how the electron spins line up are rotation invariant. There should be no preferred direction. But it's true that they can all preferentially like to line up in the same direction, whatever that direction is. And that's how you get macroscopically magnetic objects out of randomly. If you have, even though atoms like to be magnetic, they're normally randomly arranged inside a solid, so you don't get a net magnetism. But a ferromagnet is one where they're all lined up. And that's allowed, so the solution that describes a ferromagnet is allowed. It's allowed to have a direction that chooses a direction in space, even though the laws of electromagnetism that describe the interaction with the atoms is rotationally invariant. And so the environment you're living in could be being described by something which has less symmetry than the laws that are nature that are describing it. And so the picture in the standard model is that the vacuum itself is like a ferromagnet. It's like a medium. It's like water. It's like we're living in something like water. It's like the ether at some level, except it's not something which would be in contradiction with the various experiments like the Michelson-Morley experiment that Einstein had proposed relativity. But apart from that, it's very much like a medium. And the reason we have mass is that, although the laws of nature would like us not to have mass, we're living in an environment which resists our motion through it. And so that's what you mean by mass. If I push you and you don't move the way I think you're supposed to work, if you resist my pushing, that's what I would call mass. And in the standard model, that's happening because you're moving through this environment, which is the vacuum. The whole vacuum around us is this environment. So it's a very radical picture as to what the vacuum is. It's got physical properties, and that was what took so long to kind of, you know, come to realization of. But of course, because if you think of water, not everybody has the same resistance. So if you're moving through water and you have different properties, then your mass will be different. And that how the different particles in the standard model, like the electron and the muon, couple to the vacuum through which they move is why they have different masses in the standard model. They're otherwise identical, but the muon couples more strongly to the vacuum that it's moving through, and because of that it has more resistance, that's why it's more massive when we look at it.
Is there a conceptual analogy to explain why this resistance is a resistance to acceleration and not just to motion?
Why is it Aristotelian, or they want velocities to stop?
Yeah, like an analogy of a water, you know, resistance is based on the velocity that you're moving through the water.
Yeah.
The vacuum resistance seems to be only resistance against accelerations.
Yeah, if you think about why it is that if you're moving through a liquid you stop, it's because in detail what's happening is that you're interacting with the atoms of the material, and then you're radiating in light, or you're losing energy to it essentially. And essentially, what goes on here, so this is not really a good analogy, but it's kind of what's the reason why you don't lose energy in that way in this vacuum, is that there's no available ways in which you can lose energy. And so because of that, you don't stop, because there's no...
The Higgs boson or field doesn't absorb any of your energy?
No, it can't. It turns out it can't. And part of that story is if the Higgs boson had been light enough, I'm going to get to the Higgs boson in a second, but if the Higgs boson had been light enough, then you could have actually lost energy through it. But it happens that it's not light. So we know that it can't be arbitrarily light because of that. But it's a fairly weak constraint compared to the other things we already know. But it's more or less that. In principle, it could have been true that you could lose energy, but it happens that in the look at the detail of the way the vacuum works, which you can calculate in theory, it's all kind of out in front of you. There are no energy loss channels, so that's fine. You don't lose any energy. And one way you might imagine losing energy is, if you make the vacuum a physical thing, then the rules of physics are that's got consequences. It's not like you get to say that it's magical things and you'll never know that why those properties are there. Typically, one of the lessons of relativity is that there's no action at a distance. If you think that, the reason that you need an electromagnetic field is that if you have a charge, when I was a student, I remember thinking, we learn about electric forces, then we learn about electric fields, and think, what a stupid concept, electric fields. It's just a force divided by the charge, It's much more efficient to just never talk about the field and let's talk about the force, because forces are playing another role elsewhere in my life, so why would I want to know about fields? And the answer to that is that as soon as you start talking about time-dependent sources, then it makes a difference, because if you have a charge and you're all feeling the repulsion of this charge because you're also charges, if I move this charge, in the force picture, you all immediately know, so that you're now being pushed in a different direction. But in the field picture, if I move this charge, the field lines, the fields, the change in the field, the news that I've moved the charge moves out at the speed of light, and you don't know until it gets to you that I moved. And so when I move, for a while, you're still feeling a force in the wrong direction. And then later on, once the wave goes by you, then you realize, oh, it should be going that way. And that's the content of the field. There's a physical thing there that's carrying that nothing can go faster than light. Let's say relativity demands that there's something, a medium that can carry information everywhere. So the same thing has to be true for the vacuum. If it's giving you mass, you should be able to ding it or kick it and make it wiggle. There should be a way that if I change the properties, if I move things around in the vacuum, the information will move through this vacuum at some speed. There'll be waves in the vacuum, there have to be. And that's what the Higgs particle is, as opposed to the Higgs mechanism. The Higgs particle that was missing in that list is the quantum of the waves in this vacuum, ordering that's in the standard model. Yeah. So when you're looking for an energy loss mechanism. If you could excite waves in this vacuum, then that would be a way of losing energy and stopping. And the fact that it costs a minimum amount of energy because it has a mass is what forbids that process. So that's a very successful description. It's not just revolutionary and pretty. It really resolved the paradox in the 60s. People were stuck. They didn't know. They were actually giving up on quantum field theory, which is turned out to be wrong, because they didn't know how to get past this obstacle. And the way past was this idea that that the vacuum has really got physical properties. And there's a lot of analogies to that in condensed matter physics. There are examples where the same kind of things happen. But, you know, you came because of the idea, but you stay because it works so well. And so here's an example of the successes of the standard model. This is the prediction for, given that theory, you can calculate what the particles do. And this is a prediction for, actually, what happens in if you take an electron and an anti-electron and collide it as a function of the energy with which you collide it. And so this is the reaction you're looking at is electron plus positron goes into hadrons, which is just particles that take part in a strong interaction, so it's quarks and gluons and things. So could be protons and neutrons, there's all kinds of things come up. And you see that the various colored dots are measurements made at various accelerators. So these were done in an accelerator in Germany, I think it was. Petra was in California, I think it was, or vice versa, maybe. This LEP, the red ones were done, SLC is in Stanford, but LEP is the one that did most of these measurements, these ones and these ones. And that's the previous accelerator that was in the same tunnel that the Large Hadron Collider is in. It's called the Large Electron Positron Collider. It was doing this in the late 80s, early 90s. And that's why the tunnel was the size of it. They had to have special magnets to make protons go around that same tunnel, because it's harder to make protons do it than it is to make electrons do it. But they already had the tunnel, it's a good thing. And then these things are also done in LEP, but it's looking at a different final state. It's producing W particles. And the black line is the theory. And so you see that through a huge range of energies, you get it spot on. And the accuracy of that, the next slide is just going to show you, it's just numbers, but the main thing is to give you an idea of the precision of these measurements. So this is the measurement, this is the theory, and this is kind of the error in the measurement, and you can kind of see how the agreement works. It's happening at the percent, the tenth of a percent level, or better than a tenth of a percent level for some numbers. And it's not just one thing, it's a whole graph of things. And so one of these things you're not allowed to use as a mass of the Z, the first one there that looks very accurate, that's actually taken as an input. So that fixes one of the parameters in the theory. But pretty much all the rest of these things have been predicted after that. So it's very accurate. It's so accurate, I don't know if I showed you this yet. It used to be that when they were doing these measurements at LEP, they used to find that it worked really well on the weekdays, but on the weekends it never used to work. They could never get the mass as a, you know, the Z mass would change by a little bit on the weekends. And it was always a particular time of day. And somebody finally figured out that it was correlating with when the TGV, the fast train, was going from Geneva to Lyon. It's an electric train. And so basically, the current that the engine produces goes up on the wires, and then where does it get? It's trying to go to ground. And ground near Geneva is Lake Geneva, basically. So it's trying to get as efficiently as possible to Lake Geneva. And a great way to do that is this big metal tunnel that's underground near Geneva, which is where LEP was. And so, yeah, it's a great ground wire. So the current would go through there, and that actually changed their calibration of the energy of the electrons in a way that they didn't realize it was changing. And so once they figured it out, they could compensate for it. And so it gives an idea of the precision of the measurement they were doing. And another thing they detected was the moon. If you hadn't seen the moon before, they would have told you it was there. Because the moon, when it goes over, the tidal forces flex, make the crust flex in such a way that the ring changes shape. And they can see that in their measurement of the Z mass. So it's a really precise agreement.
Would that be just on the lake itself, from the effect on the lake?
They can also see the effects on the lake. But
tidal effect on the lake.
Well, they can see them both. They can see the moon when it goes by, because they can see correlate with the moon, but they can also see when the snowpack melts, for instance, they can tell because the ground relaxes.
Oh, wait a minute, mosquito fart.
Just give you an idea that this is really precision science. So the thing about the model is not just factor two, it's working really, really, really precisely. And that's important because it tells you things like the properties of the Higgs particle. The Higgs particle has never been seen, and so that means we don't know what the mass is. And the way you look for it depends on how heavy it is. And so I'm going to tell you, I'm going to try and make you make an argument that it's going to, if the Higgs is there, it can be seen at the LHC. But that really involves knowing what its properties are. And the success of the theory is it constrains its properties in an important way, which is what this slide is going to show you. So this is a plot of the mass of the Higgs against the mass of the W boson. So the Higgs has never been seen, so we don't know what it is. But the W boson has been measured, and this is an experimental measurement of its mass. And this is the error in the measurement. And this thing is that in the theory, you can calculate all these masses, because that's just how you interact with this vacuum. And so you know, you've got both the W mass and the Higgs mass, and they're related to one another through all the interactions, which you're measuring in other ways at things like at left. And so this shows you that the prediction for the Higgs mass gets larger and larger and larger the lighter the W mass gets. And this is kind of the theoretical error in prediction. So this is the black line is the central value. And you see that they agree basically as long as the Higgs is light. If you found a very, very heavy Higgs, then it would be hard to understand that in the Fermi model because that wouldn't be consistent with the success of those experiments and the known mass of the W boson. So if the Higgs particle is out there, the standard model Higgs particle, it should not be too heavy. And it should couple in very specific ways to all the particles that we know about because those couplings are the ones that are responsible for those particles' mass. So if I know their mass, I know their couplings. So everything that's known about the Higgs, everything that you need to know about the Higgs is known except for its mass, and that's constrained, is what this slide is supposed to show you. So you think you know where it should be, so then the thing is you've got to look for it. Now, that's what's good about the model. Why do we not believe it's the right answer? There's some things that are wrong with the standard model, and they come in two categories. There's things that are observationally wrong, which are, those are just wrong. And then there's things that are theoretically wrong, and those you have to kind of evaluate how seriously you take them. And there's different ones. Some you should take more seriously than others. But the ones that are really taking the bank ones are these observational ones. So there's two main observational problems. One is that the neutrinos that were there in the standard model are predicted to be exactly massless. You know, they're weakly interacting. That's why they're hard to see. That makes them also massless, it turns out. It turns out that they have an exactly zero mass in the standard model. And so the experiment is that they've now been measured to have what appears to be mass. The precise thing is that there were actually three kinds of neutrinos. I don't know if you noticed that. There's three copies of everything. So in particular, the ordinary neutrino that you get in radioactive decays comes with two copies. And the way that it was first really nailed that these neutrinos have mass is that I told you that the sun is sending us 10 billion neutrinos per square centimeter per second. You know, just a side note, there was a supernova in 1987A, which you may have heard about. That was in the next galaxy over. And for 20 seconds, it put the same number of neutrinos per second per square centimeter through the Earth. And that was like 150,000 light years away. So when those babies go off, you know, neutrinos are everywhere. It's really important. 99% of the energy comes out of neutrinos, it turns out, in that sense. So the reason that we think that neutrinos are not like the standard model tells you they are is that you can detect these neutrinos, it's just hard to do it. But they interact rarely, so what you need is a target which has got lots of stuff in it. So they started off doing, they took a tank with tons of cleaning fluid in it, which is mostly chlorine. They looked for a reaction where a neutrino would take the chlorine nucleus and turn it into argon, and then with electrons and other things. And then what they would do is they'd take this tank, and and that would happen maybe four times in a month. And after 3 months, they'd take the tank and they'd flush it, and they'd count the argon atoms, and they'd get, you know, seven out of this several tons of chlorine. And it wasn't just seven plus or minus, you know, 50. It was seven plus or minus two or something like that. And what they should have been getting from the sun was, you know, 14. And so they knew they were getting the wrong number of neutrinos from the sun, and nobody believed them for 20 years because they said, you know, yeah, sure you can count seven atoms and that's so many tons of chlorine. So what people did is they made different experiments that looked at it differently. So there was and in particular, there was one in Sudbury, which was made to detect the neutrinos using heavy water. And what's special about heavy water is that there are other detectors made in Japan and the States that look for the neutrinos through their interactions with ordinary water. And they all, basically, over 20 years, showed that the picture was right, that there was fewer neutrinos coming from the sun than you think there should be there. How do you know how many there should be? These neutrinos are being produced by the nuclear reactions that drive the sun. So because you know how bright the sun is, you know how many neutrinos should be coming out of it. And the basic problem was you're not getting as many as are coming out of it. And the complication was that you're only really sensitive to the most energetic neutrinos. So most of the neutrinos you're not seeing anyway. So there was always a question that maybe you don't know the sun very well. A lot of reasons why you might not believe this stuff. But once you have five or six experiments telling you the same thing, and the theoretical arguments got cleaner and cleaner and cleaner, so they relied on less details of the sun, then people started in the 90s to believe that there was really a problem here. But what really nailed it was the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory in Canada, because the picture was that the reason you're seeing fewer neutrinos is that there's three kinds of them, and in the standard model, only one of them is being produced by the sun. But in principle, the other two could have been produced too. And no one else could tell because they couldn't see those other neutrinos. They could just tell they're missing. But the ones that you can see are missing. And so the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, because it was heavy water, could actually see all three of the neutrinos. And so they found not only were the ones that you expected were missing, but they showed the other ones that you weren't expecting are there, and they're there at the levels so that if you add them all up, you get what the sun should be sending you. So that really nails that the problem is that the sun is sending all three of them, and they've all been seen. And if you really don't like the idea that you don't think you understand the sun, they redid the experiment where they shot neutrinos from a known accelerator source on Earth. And although it's less accurate because there's fewer neutrinos from that source than from the sun, the same effect is there. You still see that the neutrinos are missing. And so there you have control over the source. So there really is, I think, no doubt now that neutrinos are not behaving the way the standard model tells you they should behave. And that's related to neutrino mass, because if they had a mass, they'd be expected to do this thing where more than one of them come up. It can't be very big mass because they have to get here at the speed of light, more or less. But interesting thing about neutrinos and the sun is that the neutrinos get out in a second because the sun is about one light second across. Take 8 minutes to get here because they're going almost the speed of light. Whereas the light takes 8 minutes to get here, but the light from the sun takes about 100,000 years to get out of the sun. Because the sun is full of charged particles and light bounces around a lot, so it does a random walk to get out of the sun. So in principle, the sun could have turned off. That was one of the explanations. The sun could have turned off, and the neutrinos would tell you in 8 minutes, whereas the light wouldn't tell you necessarily for 100,000 years. So it could have been true that the sun turned off, and then we're just seeing that there's fewer neutrinos because that's what had happened. And so one of the things that Sudbury did was tell us that's not what's going on. The sun is shining. So second thing is that the dark matter, dark energy. In cosmology now, since the early 90s, people have been able to do a systematic head count of all the energy in the universe, you know, on average. And what they find is that if you take all the atoms in the universe, which you can count separately without actually seeing them. One way to count atoms is just to count the stars, say, and saying, well, you know how many atoms are per star? But that assumes that you're looking at for atoms that are shining. And what happened in the 90s was you could do this counting without actually seeing them with light, visible light. So there's a variety of ways of counting the total number of atoms that are there, regardless of whether they're dark or not. And what you find is that if you compare the number of atoms that are out there to the total amount of mass energy that's out there, at most something like 4 or 5% of what's out there can be ordinary atoms. But everything else is something else that we don't know about. And certainly the standard model doesn't tell you what it is, because the standard model is full of things that we would have seen, including the neutrinos. In cosmology. So this is the atoms. Everything else is something different. And the bigger surprise in the late 90s was that there's two kinds of something different. There's dark matter, which seems to be gravitating like everything else is in galaxies. If you can basically measure the mass of a galaxy or a cluster of galaxies in a variety of ways, and they give you about 100 times more stuff than you would see by counting. But independent of that, there's something else out there which is making the universe accelerate. And the expansion of the universe is actually speeding up, and that's something which ordinarily gravitating things won't do, because normally gravity is always attractive. It's always slowing down the expansion of the universe. And so it was a big surprise to find that the universal expansion was not slowing down, it was speeding up. And dark matter, the thing in the galaxies, can't fix that, because it was inferred, its existence was inferred using the fact that it gravitates in an ordinary way. So there's two kinds of things out there that the standard model doesn't really explain. The dark energy, depending on who you ask, you could say the standard model does explain, because if the vacuum had an energy density, that would do what dark energy needs to do. So there's a sense in which the standard model is not, the standard model doesn't predict the vacuum energy. The standard model isn't inconsistent with the energy having a vacuum. You know, it has properties, why shouldn't it have an energy? The problem with that in the standard model is that if you can predict the vacuum energy, and it should be huge, and it's not anywhere near as big as the standard model would say it would be. So that's why most people would say the standard model doesn't predict the dark energy. But the best way to present this slide as physics teachers is that we can give the chemists this, but the understanding this is physics. So that's what a lot of research is.
Well, she doesn't show up.
Now, there are theoretical problems. I'm not going to come to those here. There's a whole bunch of theoretical problems. The cosmological constant problem is this dark energy thing I was alluding to. The vacuum energy is predicted to be bigger than otherwise. The who word this problem is, why are the three copies of everything? What about gravity problem is one, what about gravity? These things down here, you know, they're problems, but they're kind of aesthetic problems, in the sense that you needn't solve them at the LHC. It might be that maybe those will be solved 100 years from now. The cosmological constant problem is one that I think it's a more pressing problem for a variety of reasons. The hierarchy problem is the one I want to focus on, because that's the one that I think most professional physicists would take as being the biggest theoretically urgent problem in the standard model. It's something which it shows you that the standard model independent of dark matter, or independent of dark matter and independent of neutrino masses, something has to be fixed. Something has to change at an energy that the LHC will see. Neutrino masses could be, what gives you neutrino masses could be something at very high energies which the LHC may never see. So the fact that the Fermat is wrong may be cold comfort, because we may still not know how it's wrong in that particular, for neutrino masses, after the LHC is finished. The hierarchy problem is the problem that is the one that is the best evidence that the something here actually really is failing at the energies the LHC should be able to play. So I want to do a couple slides just motivating that. It's kind of a hard idea to get across, because it's kind of a nitty-gritty thing for theory. So if it's not clear what I'm saying, don't worry about it. But this is kind of in cartoon form the essence of it. Imagine the whole story is the vacuum has physical properties. So forget about vacuum. Think of water. Water has physical properties. And because it's got physical properties, it has different phases, right? So if this is temperature and this is pressure, these are the phases of water. It's a gas over here. It's a liquid over here. It's various kinds of ice over here. And these black lines are the coexistence curves. So if you go from here to here and you heat things up and things boil, that's what we're used to. Somewhere around here is atmospheric pressure, which I never remember where it is, but you can figure it out by going to room temperature, I guess, and 100 degrees up. So that atmospheric pressure must be somewhere around 100. Yeah.
10 to the 5.
10 to the 5, there you go. 3, 4, 5, yeah, there it is. So then that's the boiling point of water on Earth. But it changes as a function of temperature. And at the end here, there's this critical point. If you actually have enough pressure, and then you heat the water, it just becomes steam and it never actually goes to a boiling point. So there's no latent heat at that point. Here, if you boil things, it sits there for a long time at 100 degrees until it all turns to vapor. And then you're converting the energy of the liquid into the gas, and the temperature doesn't change. Whereas here, the temperature just go up and up and up and up. There'll be no latent heat. So if you were, you can calculate the temperatures that are associated with this point here, for instance, because you know that what's going on is that it's this water molecules that are all interacting electromagnetically. You know how that works. And you need to know how much energy it costs to liberate the liquid and make it into gas. It's not easy to do, but you can get it. You can figure it out. And the fact is, it too might be hard, but the order of magnitude is something you can get right. And so the fact that this is at hundreds of degrees is something which follows from the fact that we know how strong electromagnetism is, and we know kind of how much energy there is in a water molecule. And so if it were true that somebody gave you a water phase diagram and told you that critical point was actually here at extremely low temperatures, that would be a surprise, because that would mean that the basic physics that you think is underlying this phase transition is wrong at some point. The energy scales that are involved and the forces involved are not corresponding to the energies that you're really seeing when you make a transition from one phase to the other. Now, essentially, in the standard model, that's what happens, is that we know that the vacuum has properties. There's a phase vacuum, just like this. If you heat the vacuum up, it'll do something different. If you go to high enough temperatures, eventually what will happen is that it will melt, and then everybody that you think is massive will now be massless, because that ordering will no longer be there. And so all those things have happened in the early universe, when the universe was hotter. But what we know is that the basic scales of the problem, oh, I got rid of that slide. But there's a hidden slide here which you have to know about. This is the slide I thought was in. But the words, I think, there's a whole bunch of scales that you can't see because they're behind the picture, are not so informative. But the basic statement is that we know that the standard model is not the only game in town. We know that gravity exists. And we know that the standard model particles all have masses that are in a ballpark, which is set by the typical energy scales of the standard model. It's like the mass of the proton, or the range of masses in the standard model run from the proton to about 100 times the proton. There's a couple that are lighter than that, like the electron. But that's more or less, they're all in the same ballpark. Because they all couple with roughly the same strengths of this vacuum that they're getting mass from. But there's a mass scale hidden in Newton's constant. If you combine it with Planck's constant and the speed of light, it gives you a mass scale. And that mass scale is enormous compared to all the mass scales that we know about in particle physics. In units of the proton mass, the mass scale that Newton's constant points you towards is something like 10 to the 18 times higher. Whereas the LHC is going to be probing like 1,000 or 10,000 times higher than the proton mass. So there's a very, very, very large scale associated with gravity, and that's really just saying that gravity is weak. And you have more intuition about why gravity is weak, because the fact that gravity is weak is another way of saying astrophysical objects are large, right? If you ask why the sun is big, it's because the sun is a balance between nuclear reactions that are trying to get energy out and gravity, which is always trying to compress things. And you're balancing for a long period of time because you can do that as long as you're burning things in the middle of the sun. And eventually when you run out of gas, then it'll collapse. But the fact that you need so much material to get gravity to compete with nuclear reactions is because gravity is so weak compared to nuclear forces. And so you can, this mass scale I'm talking about, you can estimate the mass of the sun in terms of the ratio of that mass scale coming from Newton's constant divided by what's called the Planck mass, divided by the proton mass. Turns out to be Planck mass cubed divided by the proton mass squared is basically the mass of the sun. And that's because it's a balance of these two forces that you can work out. And the basic problem is that we're finding that the standard model, so in a scale of nature, there's a very big mass scale in the problem, which is up here somewhere. But all the phase transitions in the standard model associated with the standard model are down here somewhere. And so there's a puzzle as to why should it be true that things, the particles that we know about, can be so light compared to everything else. Because that essentially says that in the phase diagram of the standard model, the things that are getting mass, the phase transitions are all associated with very little energy compared to the basic scales that we know. The highest energy scales that we know are in the problem. It happens that these phase transitions are very sensitive to the highest scales in the problem, and no one really knows why the standard model should be different than any other. We know lots of phase transitions in nature, and none of them work this way. So if the standard model works this way, it's the first time ever. So there's something funny about the standard model that doesn't smell right. And that thing, resolving that thing is what's driving that's called the hierarchy problem. Why is the scales of the particle physics, why are they so different from the scales in gravity? So that guides a little bit of what people look for in the LHC. So what can the LHC see? I'm running really late here, so let me kind of skip to this quickly. So one option might be nothing. And so there's reason to believe that that's not going to happen. And that's because we know that the standard model without nothing means not even the Higgs particle, just nothing. It's just particles we've seen up right now. That can't be true because the standard model itself says that the standard model without the Higgs particle is inconsistent, independent of the whole mass story. If you look at the scattering of, say, W particles with each other as a function of energy, the scattering likelihood grows like the logarithm of the energy. But quantum mechanics says that there's a general upper limit to how much things can scatter, just based on the probability. The sum of the mutually exclusive alternatives has to add to one, the probabilities of all those things. And if your cross sections or your scattering probabilities are growing too fast, they'll eventually violate that, and that can't be true. And so it turns out that cross sections can never grow faster than 1 over energy squared in any reasonable quantum mechanical theory. So this has to fail at energy, and you can figure out that energy in terms of the W mass and the coupling of electromagnetism. And it's basically the energies that the LHC is going to probe. In the standard model, this problem doesn't happen because if you put the Higgs particle in, there's a scattering process which involves exchanging the Higgs particle, and that cancels this bad behavior and gives you what a reasonable theory has to give you. So if the Higgs particle is there, the standard model can make sense to very high energies. But without the Higgs particle, something has to happen at the energy of the LHC to see. So if the Higgs particle is not there in some way, something should have to replace it at the energies that the LHC can access. And that was kind of how its design was made. Now, what about the Higgs particle? This is really a slide to show you that you can find the Higgs particle. And the reason it looks busy is that you don't actually see the Higgs particle. You see what it decays into. But what is the Higgs particle? It's the thing that's the waves in the vacuum. It'll decay into what couples to it the strongest. But we know what couples to it the strongest. Those are the guys that are the most massive because they get their mass from coupling to the Higgs. The ordering of the Higgs in the vacuum. So the Higgs should likely decay into the heaviest thing it can decay into, but it won't be the heaviest thing because if the heaviest thing is heavier than the Higgs is, then it can't decay without having violating energy conservation. So it'll decay into the lightest thing that's lighter than it is. So what that is depends on how heavy it is. So this is showing you what it decays into as a fraction of time against the mass of the Higgs. And so this is 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 2, and 1 at the top. So something like this, which is just about 10 to the minus 2, says that 1 in 100, once in 100, or 2 times in 100, the Higgs will decay into this particular particle. So these are blue ones. And what that shows you is that it likes to decay into what's BB bar up there. That's bottom quarks. If the Higgs is 80 GeV, that's 80 times the mass of the proton, then it'll almost always go into bottom quarks because those are the next thing that's lighter than Higgs at that point is the bottom quark, but it's much lighter. And after that is the tau particle, which is like a muon but heavier. And so it essentially likes to go to the bottom quark, but as it gets heavier, it stops doing that. It likes to go into W particles because those are heavier than the bottom quark, so it prefers to go down. So what you look for in the decay of the Higgs depends on how massive it is, and we don't know how massive it is. So that's why you have to kind of have a strategy which depends on what its mass is. We think it's probably light down here. But that could mean that you're looking for bottom quarks, it could mean you're looking for things in here. We don't know. It could be anywhere in its range, pretty much, and not be because of the scattering model. So they've got a strategy which looks at all these different kinds of things, and this is just supposed to show you that they all work. That if you were to look in these various channels, so this is into two photons, the bottom quarks is this blue line, it's the one that's very low energies. This is the mass of the Higgs again. This is the statistical significance of what they can see at the LHC. Anything above this is 5 sigma. That's what they normally require to say that they discovered something. And the fact that all these, so any one process, like in bottom quarks, it would be easy to see if it's light, but it becomes less convincing, less heavy, because the reaction is becoming more rare. And so the fact that the envelope here is always above 5 sigma says that they've designed this thing, the detector, so they can see the Higgs no matter what mass it has. Regardless of what it decays into, they think they can find it. That's what that tells you. So if the standard model Higgs is what's there, we'll know. Now, what about beyond standard model? If standard model is wrong, as it almost certainly is, now there's three categories which I want to close with, and they're motivated by this hierarchy problem in a way which may not be very clear. So the first category is the conservatively easy one. So it's a historically conservative one. That is that things that we think are elementary particles now might be made of something else. So the same way that protons are made of gluons and quarks, maybe the quarks are made of something else, maybe the electrons are made of something else. There's no evidence for it now, but it could happen. And one way we could find that out is this. And that would actually, if the Higgs itself was made of something else, that would be something which would make progress on this hierarchy problem. The second thing to go is, this is telling you it's conservative. The second way to go is what's called supersymmetry. In the same way that people could predict any particles back in the 30s by reconciling relativity and quantum mechanics, this hierarchy problem suggests that if we duplicated the number of the particles that we already have, if every boson, every spinless particle, every particle that satisfies Bose statistics, like photons do, if there was another one like electron that satisfies Fermi statistics, obeys the Pauli exclusion principle, but has the same mass and the same couplings, that would alleviate this problem. So the supersymmetry is an option which includes proposals which basically duplicate and more the particles we see, and they're the same thing. So this is the best illustration I found on the web. So the bottom part you should read first. It's a supersymmetry for every liberal douche. There's a conservative with an equal magnitude of doucheness. And then the example was supposed to be that I think the guy who did this thinks that Gore is a douche, but then the guy who made this poster is an equally big douche, because this says liberals best served with a liberal helping them shut the fuck up. But it's basically the idea is that you take things you have and you do them. So all the particles we know about here, all these new particles that are predicted by supersymmetry are there, and they have specific properties coming from this new symmetry. There's various reasons to believe. If you took a poll amongst physicists now, this is what they'd say is probably going to happen. And that's because there's hints that it's happening already. So this is an example. This is the W mass plotted against the top mass. So it's the same kind of spirit as what I showed you for the Higgs mass against the W mass. You can predict all these things in the standard model. And the red thing is what the standard model would predict as a function with the errors. And this is the experiment. So it's kind of not really agreeing very well. This is like a 3 sigma alignment thing. And this is what supersymmetry would predict. So people tend to think that there's hints of supersymmetry already happening. So that's kind of why many people would present this as the orthodoxy, even though it sounds a little bizarre. And there's other things that are apparently about it. The last option is actually what I believe in. It's the one that, so this is kind of the out-of-the-box option, because these first two came, as soon as people have thought there was a problem, the next day they had these two proposals. This took about 15 years to come up with, because basically, it says that the reason you think there's a problem is that you think that gravity is giving you a big, large scale, and you're implicitly thinking there are particles out there with that large mass. But that might not be true. It might be true. That's really all, the reason that you think there's a large scale there is that what you really know is that gravity is a weak force. And so it might be true that you're being fooled into thinking there are particles out there with the same mass. And although people made that argument before, what happened in the mid-90s was people realized in detail how you could actually make that work. How would it be possible to have only light particles and still have gravity be very weak? And the basic idea is that if there's more than four dimensions, gravity gets weaker the farther away you get from things. There's an inverse square law. But the inverse square law, the square in the inverse square law is a function of us living in three space dimensions. All the force lines are going out, and if you intercept them with a sphere, you always intercept the same number of lines. And so that means the number of force lines has to go like 1/(1/) area, which goes like radius squared. That's why Coulomb's law and Newton's law were the same. They had to be the same from that argument. But if we lived in 9 space dimensions, say, it would go like 1/r^8, so it would fall faster. So one way in which you could have gravity be weak without actually having the scale of gravity be very large would be there's extra dimensions that you're not seeing, and so the force lines are actually falling off like one over RDA, say, until they get up to the size of the extra dimension. So if you
and that helps explain why the universe is expanding and accelerating in expansion.
Not necessarily, but it's not inconsistent with it. So the idea is that if you have a mass, the force lines are all going like one over expanding like they would in extra dimensions. But as they get to the size of the extra dimensions, they all have to turn over because there's no place to go. And so then they start to fall like 1 over r squared. And so you could lose a lot in this first part, and if you didn't know those dimensions were there, then that would be an explanation for why gravity is weak. Turns out that it has to be really weak, though. So if you want to have the gravity scale be the same as all the other particle physics scales, these extra dimensions have to be like 10 microns across. So that's actually quite big compared to things we think we understand. So what took so long in this kind of an idea was how could you hide dimensions that are that large? And it turns out it's possible to do. But the smoking gun is you test Newton's law to see if Newton's law, you can't hide extra dimensions from gravity because gravity is space-time. So Newton's law would have to break down, the inverse square law would have to fail at about 10 microns or so. And it's been tested down to about 50 microns now. So we're kind of on the hairy edge of this kind of proposal. But if that were there, that would have spectacular consequences for you. And one of them would be black holes. That's why people, they're not crazy, these people that say they could have black holes in the LHC. Most of us are hoping they will find black holes in the LHC, because that's the spectacular answer. They won't eat the Earth. They think they'll eat the Earth for all the usual reasons, you know, like the Hollywood and life science. But they get a lot of details right in this, this is the last few slides. They get a lot of details right there's great movies. If you actually look, I was looking for damaged slides of the LHC when it broke. If you look for damage of the LHC, you get all these movies about how the Earth is going to be eaten. So there's one which is a good of the soundtrack, which I've only got a couple slides of here, where it eats France, and then I guess I didn't have that, so. It eats France, and then it eats half the Earth, and you see the black hole. But they get a lot of details right in the sense of where it starts here. Here's Geneva, here's the airport, here's CERN. So if you kind of look at where that is at the LHC, CERN is here, Atlas is here, CMS, the other detector, was over here. They're right that the black hole would start here, because the beam goes in here. The first time it meets is on the other side. And so that's, you know, they got a lot of details right when they get this thing in. They have just enough physics to hurt themselves at some point. And you'll never beat them because, you know, so CERN has web pages too, but you have to find them on Google because they're not, you know, they're not the first things you hit in Google. So this one is, it has the Large Hadron Collider destroyed the world yet. If you go there, you get that. if you go to the page source, which you can go to by the view menu, and there's a thing down here you might not have seen, which says that if the LHC actually destroys the Earth and this page isn't updated, then please email me right now. They don't have quite enough, as much time as these guys do, but what's the bottom line? Let me finish because I'm way over now. So the LHC started. We in the field we've been waiting for 20 years for it to start. It's a great thing. It's going to be running at full energies in a year or so still. It's not quite up. It's crippled. It's like a jalopy that you're afraid to push it too hard. But it will be eventually the BMW that you hope to get. And it's going to be great. It's very rare that you get to say that there's going to be a revolution in science. And it's predictably coming. Because it's almost always true that when you get an accelerator that cuts really into the energies that you have never been able to reach before, that you find something which is revolutionary. Particularly, and there's many theoretical reasons why that should happen in the standard model. So it's what we call in science the holy shit moment. It's really, really, really here, and it's something which is going to be revolutionary.
Interesting.
And so the very, very least, it will tell us what the Higgs mechanism is. The Higgs has to be there, or else the LHC will see something if it's not there. If the Higgs is there, for theorists it would be boring, because we kind of expect the Higgs to be there, or something like it. But it'll really be revolutionary. It's going to say that the vacuum has physical properties, and the fact that you have mass is a response to those properties. And that the discovery of the Higgs would be seeing the vibrations in that vacuum. And that will be amazing. It's a real change in our picture of what the vacuum is. But the hope is that we're going to be surprised, because almost always, it's the things that you don't see coming are the ones that are the most interesting. So my personal pick is large extra dimensions, and I can tell you why in detail. If you ask. Anyway, there's more websites, so thanks for your time. Sorry to run late.
Thanks.